As Wayne said, we've organised our talks today a little bit like a patchwork quilt. Each speaker is going to deal with a slightly different topic, but actually we're all overlapping to some extent. But hopefully at the end of the day, you will have a good understanding of tannins in plants, their effects on animals, their effects on animal products, and on environmental emissions. So I'm now going to continue from Wayne's talk, but I'm going to focus on a few additional tannin essays. I'm also going to mention some of the myths that have been in the literature for rather far too long. So be careful when you read the old literature, some of the younger ones amongst you. And I'm going to conclude with some of the some thoughts where this research might take us in the future, because I truly believe there's tremendous potential in this area. So I'm going to start first with a couple of mass spectrometry methods. Multi-TOF mass spectrometry is an excellent technique because it can tell us which tannin molecules are present in an extract. So you get one peak per tannin molecule. And this is the first technique that actually told us something about the complexity of tannins that occur in plants. You saw Wayne's talk with all those lines of sheep. And that information came from this technique. So here on the left, you have a peak that relates to a tannin called a procyanidine that only has catechin in it. On the right, you have a prodelphinidine that only has gallocatechin in it. These are homopolymers. But in the middle, you have three tannins that are heteropolymers. They are mixtures of catechin and gallocatechin. Unfortunately, this method is not quantitative, and it only can analyze tannins in extracts and not in whole plants. Our Finnish collaborators have developed another mass spectrometry method, and this one is quantitative. It's called UPLC-MSMS, and it provides us with quantitative information on tannin contents, on tannin composition in terms of procyanidins, prodelphinidins, and even size. And you see here very good correlations between the thiolysis method, data here, and the UPLC mass spectrometry method, the UPLC method here, and the John Grubber tannin method, and so on. The good thing about this method is it's really fast. In a few minutes, 5 minutes, you get your answer. Thiolysis takes you several days. And plant breeders, of course, need fast tools. But this method also can only analyze tannins in extracts and not in whole plants. And this is why I'm now showing you another method that is capable of analyzing tannin content and composition in whole plants. It's called near-infrared spectroscopy. It's a relatively old study. We do have much better results now, but they're not yet published. What you see here is that NILS has the promise to achieve fairly good predictions. The NIR data are predicted data, and they are based on analyzing a large number of different samples in the laboratory. And the laboratory data are the measured data, which are on the y-axis. So tannin contents, whether determined by the HCl butanol method or the thiolysis method, correlate pretty well with the predicted data, and the same in terms of composition, prodelphinidins or stereochemistry cis-trans, reasonable predictions. This method is fast. But in order to apply it in real life for plant breeders, they would need a lot more data analyzed in the laboratory first to get robust correlations. But I think there's very good opportunity to achieve that. Tannin compositions are complicated, and for a long time we've actually never quite known whether the methods we have could actually detect the tannins we were interested in. And this is why I've been doing so much method comparison between different labs. and also with the Finnish laboratory. And here you see one interesting comparison from one of my students. It's quite a recent study. She looked at tannin contents in willow leaves. And we have access to a very large germplasm collection at the Rothamsted Research Institute just north of London in the UK. And you see a almost perfect correlation, a one-to-one correlation in the blue population E, but a pretty poor correlation in the purple population F. I don't really know why. I've got some guesses, but can't be sure. And what you can also see here, and this is what we often find, the HCl butanol method tends to, and there is acetone in this one, tends to yield higher values than the thiolysis. The thiolysis reagent is not as powerful as the acetone or the ABA method. So you've heard from Wayne, there are lots of different types of tannins, B type, A type, cis, trans, etc. And you've also heard there are soluble and insoluble tannins. So mass spectrometry is brilliant at measuring the soluble tannins, but the soluble tannins tend to be the smaller tannins, and that's what we found out with thiolysis. Plants produce a large amount of insoluble tannins, and they are really, really sticky with their little feet. They like to stick to fibers and to protein and can be really difficult to take off. The problem is that many foods and feeds contain large amounts of these large insoluble tannins. And I believe it's important that we analyse whole plants and not just extracts. Whole plants, whether it's by animal, by NIOS, by the HCl butanol method or by the thiolysis method. I believe these tannins need to be analysed, because otherwise we've got a whole iceberg of tannins which we're not actually measuring. And interestingly, in the human nutrition literature, there is now a groundswell of opinion that these insoluble tannins may actually have quite important nutritional and health effects on us humans. Just as we thought we managed to develop good methods, we then apply this to a silage, and we detect that thiolysis doesn't work. So the fresh sample that was freeze-dried, thiolysis gave us a result of 3.1% tannins. After ensiling, we found hardly anything, 0.4% tannins. And so Aina Ramsey has just published a paper where she spent a long time trying to figure out what to do with these tannins, because by HCl butanol she could see they were present, but not by thiolysis. She found that if she subjected the silage to sodium hydroxide and then did the thiolysis afterwards, those bound tannins were released and she was able to measure them. Interestingly, once they were released, the tannins in the silage had similar composition as the original tannins in terms of tannin size and in terms of prodelphinidine composition. Now, if tannins were inert, and this is what really the literature will tell you, they are condensed, and they don't hydrolyze. Don't believe this. If tannins were inert, you would expect during fermentation tannin content to increase, because part of the organic matter is being fermented, is disappearing. But actually, both by the HCl butanol method and the thiolysis method, we find that silages have 20 to 30% less tannins. And we don't know where these tannins are going, what's happening to them, how they are reacting. So we talked about the soluble and the strongly bound tannins. When tannin-containing forages are processed, something happens to tannins. These are averages from our work and from the literature data from Sunfoin, Sala, Birdsford trefoil, all tannin-containing forages. On average, a third of the tannins in the fresh forages are strongly bound. Once the samples are pelleted, approximately 50% of the tannins are strongly bound. And in silage forages, 85% of the tannins are strongly bound. Now, Tom, you may be talking about it. You haven't found any effects between the soluble and the bound tannins in terms of anthelmintic deworming activities. But I really wonder whether in terms of nutrition there could be an effect. Because presumably if the protein, the tannins are binding the protein strongly, I assume it's going to affect the digestion. No one has looked at that yet. So now I'm going to talk about the myths. So in the old literature, you'll find some amazing, interesting contradictions. Tannins are accidents of nature, waste products of biochemical processes in plants. Or maybe plants make them to defend themselves against herbivores, and therefore tannins must be toxic. The toxic idea comes from the fact that tannins bind strongly to proteins and are very astringent, so they don't taste. Some of them don't taste very, very nice. But actually, this made no sense to me as a young chemist when I started out in this field. Different plants consistently produce different types of tannins. Why would they put all this enzymatic, biosynthetic machinery in place to differentiate between each other? Why don't they all produce the same kind of rubbish waste products? And the toxic tannins, which can kill animals, such as oak tannins, bean tannins, or which are strongly anti-nutritional, such as the bean tannins, well, those tannins don't occur in forage legumes. And we knew that even in the 1980s. There was enough known about it. But animal nutritionists, not talking to chemists, had one view of it. So I then tried to look into this research because I was really interested which type of tannins generated the beneficial effects of the forage legumes. And so I started this treasure hunt in 1983 to differentiate between the good and the bad tannins. The only problem was that the grant reviewers kept responding to our applications. Tannins are toxic, therefore we are not funding it. They're anti-nutritional, we're not funding it. So it took a long time to overcome these roadblocks. The problem was, this was the information they were taught 20, 50 years ago when they had been students, and that's what the textbooks were still saying. So our luck changed in 2006 when the EU finally funded a large project. An interdisciplinary project across the EU which involves 17 partners, 13 countries and 30 PhD students. Together we took a concerted multidisciplinary approach to identifying and studying the unique benefits of sunfoin, that's one tannin containing forage. Our partners at Cambridge, NIAP, they set up a germplasm collection of different sunfoin accessions and evaluated the agronomy and taxonomy of sunfoin. This collection was used by our animal nutritionists for nutritional and environmental studies, and it was also used by our parasitology colleagues and for chemical analysis. Our aims were to develop rapid tools that could be used by plant breeders to kickstart a sunfoin breeding program in Europe. And here you can see that sunfoin contains a wide range of different tannins, 1 to 10%, but that applies to all of the other tannin-containing forage legumes as well. And there are huge differences between the different legumes. Birdsfoot trefoil in general tends to have low tannin contents. Sericea and canary clover tend to have very high tannin contents. Here you see the variation that we obtained from the germplasm collection in Cambridge. Tannin contents ranged from 0.6 to 2.8%. Tannin size, that is the polymer size with the different building blocks, the multicolor building blocks. The smallest Sanfoin accession had only on average 12 flavanol units stuck together, but the largest, from the US being the largest, had 84 flavanol units stuck together. Prodelphinidins varied from about 50 to almost 100%, trans from 17 to 32%. You can also see that the leaf morphology in that germplasm collection varied enormously. So given this wide range of tannin composition, it's perhaps not surprising that there were actually contradictions in the literature as well about the nutritional value of Sanfoin. In the UK, the highest ever recorded lamb growth rates of 400 grams per day were recorded with Sanfoin. But our partners in other countries actually have found poor growth rates with Sanfoin. Tannins also vary with season. So this is a study by our French partners. As the season progresses, tannin contents go up, tannin size goes up, and prodelphinidin concentrations go up. Tannins also vary with plant parts. So leaves tend to have more tannins than stems, both in Sanfoin and Sericea, tend to have larger tannins than stems, and more prodelphinidins than stems. But, and I mustn't forget that because I'm going to come back to that right at the end, you've seen all this variation now with in tannin concentrations and compositions, but a Swiss study found a very small number of Sanfoin accessions that had much more stable tannin profiles. I'm going to come back to that later. So now I'm going to focus on some of the results from our various European partners. As you know, when forages are fermented in the rumen, hydrogen is generated. Hydrogen is a strong reducing agent, and it leads to methane production. It also converts PUFAs, polyunsaturated fatty acids, into saturated fatty acids. This conversion is undesirable because PUFAs in plants or in foods have very beneficial effects. You will have heard that it is good to eat fish oils because it's good for brain development. PUFAs are also good at minimizing inflammatory diseases, oxidative stress, and improving cardiovascular health. So our partners at Wageningen University in the Netherlands looked at the effect of Sanfoin silage on biohydrogenation. They fed linseed, which is a rich source of PUFAs, to dairy cows and compared the effect of Sanfoin silage against grass silage as the control. You see here that Sanfoin silage significantly reduced methane emission per gram of dry matter intake, significantly increased milk yield per day, and PUFA concentrations in milk. Our Swiss partners compared Sanfoin pellets and looked at the effect of PUFAs in milk and cheese made from this milk. And the control here was alfalfa pellets. Again, they also used linseeds as a source of PUFA. So one of the PUFA fatty acids increased in milk, but several of the PUFAs significantly increased also in the cheese made from this milk. Our Swiss partners then looked at the effect of PUFAs in the fat of lamb meat. And here they compared two tannin-containing silages, Burtford trefoil and Sanfoin, against alfalfa silage. Both tannin-containing forages increased several of the PUFAs significantly, but Sanfoin was more potent, increased the PUFA content more. And interestingly, Sanfoin silage also reduced scatol. And scatol is a compound that generates the off flavor in lamb meat. That's why some people don't like to eat lamb meat. And that ties in with results by other people who studied sala and canary clover, two other tannin-containing forages. And I'm going to give you a brief update where we are in terms of breeding sanfoin, better sanfoin accessions. You're probably aware with the work, aware of the work that's going on at Lethbridge in Canada. They've been quite keen on sanfoin. They've been working on it for over a number of years because a small amount of sanfoin in an alfalfa diet can significantly reduce bloat incidence. So at Lethbridge, they have now developed new sanfoin populations that can be grown in pure stands and give higher yields, that are suitable for co-cultivation with alfalfa, and that can be grazed or cut several times. However, these sanfoin populations are not suitable for drought conditions or variable rainfall conditions. In contrast, in Europe, we are particularly interested in sanfoin because it's a drought-resistant forage. It can still produce something green for animals to eat when all the grass has turned brown. So our partners at Aberystwyth Universities, IBER in Wales in the UK, have therefore performed a genomics analysis on sanfoin. As you know, DNA sequencing technology nowadays is relatively cheap, and this has enabled them to acquire genomics data for a minor crop such as sanfoin, for which there is really very little sequencing information available. They've undertaken an RNA sequencing experiment to obtain a library of the sanfoin transcriptome, and the sequencing and associated bioinformatics analysis then provided them with 100,000 different transcripts. They were able to assign function to these transcripts in order to obtain information on the key biological processes, molecular functioning, and cell location of the genes. And you can see that in the top figure. It's rather small because the paper is being written at the moment, but it should be coming out soon. They were also able to obtain quantitative information on the different gene expression levels, and that's in the bottom figure. Of particular interest to me is the fact that they were able to obtain information on the TANNIN pathway genes. So these sequence data can now be mined for molecular markers, such as SSR markers, which will be very useful for genetic diversity studies, for pedigree analysis of sanfoin breeding populations. And a huge number of SNPs are available, which can be used for genome-wide association studies and for genomics-assisted plant breeding in the future. So this team has made fantastic progress. Our Swiss partners were really well organized, as the Swiss are, and prepared a large number of different sanfoin crosses before our Legume Plus project even started. And they did that in the greenhouse. And as you know, perhaps, sanfoin is, according to the literature, is an outbreeder. It's self-infertile. Well, I'm afraid 65% of the crosses which were performed in the greenhouse with bumblebees resulted from self-fertilization, which was a bit of a disaster for that PhD project as it was planned originally. Then they did the same. I'm coming to the end. Then they did the same analysis for field-grown plants and crosses, and only 4% were from self-fertilization. Okay, of course it depressed yield and seed yield and so on and vigor, but that information is now actually quite useful for future breeding programs, and the paper has just been published. Our Swiss partners have also found 106 SSR markers from 35 different genotypes, and these SSR markers have a good amount of polymorphism. Their genome-wide association studies are ongoing. They have also sequenced three different sanfoin populations, obtained more than 1 million SNPs, again also with useful polymorphism, and work on trait marker associations are ongoing. So to sum up now, TANNIN contents and compositions vary enormously within species and between species. That perhaps can be the explanation for some of the contradictory results on the nutritional value of sunfoin. Clearly, sunfoin, whether in the form of pellets or silage, has beneficial effects on PUFAs in milk, cheese, and meat. Together, we all have made tremendous progress on analytical methods for tannin analysis. More work needs to be done. We now finally have genetic information on sunfoin, which is enabling identification of SSR and SNP markers, and should provide a basis for a future sunfoin breeding program. Well, do we still have questions? I'm afraid so, quite a few. And I'm hoping that perhaps at the end of the day we'll have a chance to discuss this a little bit, because I wonder whether we need different sunfoin varieties to control parasites and to enhance nitrogen utilization in ruminants. We also don't yet know how best to utilize tannin-containing forages. Should animals graze low tanning forages, or would it be better to supplement their diets with high tannin forages? Does it matter whether tannins are strongly bound during processing? And now, lastly, I do want to mention a nice result by one of my students. There appear to be synergies between tannins and other phenolics. And this is just the start. So I think there's a whole new area that's opening up. So plenty more work that can be done. Where would I like us to be in 10, 20 years' time? Clearly, farmers need varieties that have predictable tannin concentrations with predictable effects. We need analytical tools that can predict animal responses. And for this, I think what we really need to do, in order, Mark, to your question earlier on and your answer to it, analysing tannins for large animal feeding trials, I think is difficult. But if we have well-defined different types of sunfoin varieties, high PC, low PC, large tannin sizes, low tannin sizes, then we can do feeding trials with these kind of varieties. In terms of antiparasitic structure activity relationship, tannins and their effects, I think we've made a lot of progress. But in terms of nutritional effects, yes, we have the in vitro studies. A lot of work has been published on that. But animal feeding trials need to be done to really nail this down. I think it will be possible to develop varieties that are more robust and more predictable. And here I'm showing you a really old study from 1991. It's not tannins, but it's polyphenols. And these are polyphenols we analyzed in different sorghum accessions that were grown at four different sites in Ethiopia. They varied, the polyphenol patterns varied between all the sites and almost all the accessions. But 2 out of 25 accessions, and one of them is shown here, has got pretty good fingerprints that didn't change very much between the different sites. And I believe, and I hope, this may also be possible for our tannin-containing forages. We want weatherproof, climate-proof tannin fingerprints that are repeatable and relatively robust. And I want to thank the whole European team that contributed to this work since 2006. And I'm not going to forget Gary Barcorn. I know quite a few of you know him. We've got permission to show him here. He's been a tremendous support for Legium Plus and has been so freely giving in his advice. And thank you to Forest Genetics and Organic Valley for sponsoring the symposium. Thank you.